session number 27075, reel 26.
Squadron Leader Leggett, reel 26. Squadron Leader, you were just telling me about joining the operational training unit, and that was based in the canal zone. What did your duties entail there when you arrived?
Yes, well, I was wheeled into the station commander, Crew Captain John Grandy, who had been a former CO of 249 Squadron in the Battle of Britain at North Weald. And he announced that I was to be given command of B flight, or was it A flight? One of the two, which is a Spitfire flight. We had two Spitfire flights and four Kitty Hawk flights. And straight away, we settled down to passing on to the intakes as they arrived, what we had learned during our days in combat with the enemy.
I imagine that changed quite considerably from your own training, where you mentioned earlier, obviously in the Battle of Britain, how little training you got.
Oh yes.
Was there a general ethos then within the Air Force to pass on combat experience?
Oh yes, by this time it was realised that this was an essential ingredient into the training of any pilot. And the pupils were given a carefully drawn up syllabus, which we as at the operating end passed on to the new intakes. They came from all over the place, some from UK, some were from Hurricane squadrons in the desert, several from Rhodesia, and quite a large number from South Africa. And the South Africans were, in fact, South African Air Force personnel, not Royal Air Force. They wore their own uniforms and so on. They were good guys, the South Africans. We liked them. One or two of them were very, very strong. I've forgotten the name. The Voortrekkers.
Boers.
Yeah, the Boers, yes. They were from Boer, very strong Boer background. At first, it seemed they might be rather difficult. Not at all. They were great guys. And everybody at Eberswehr got on very well indeed. And not the least of this was due to the fact that not only was John Grandy our station commander, but also Neville Duke was the chief flying instructor. Neville Duke had recently come back from the desert himself, having commanded a Spitfire squadron, and he was indeed the youngest squadron commander in the Air Force at any time. He was even younger than I was, so he's quite a young fellow. And a good guy, too. He told us what the program comprised and then left us to get on with it. And life indeed was very good. We worked sensible, regular hours. There was no tremendous pressure to push people through the school quickly. Everything went along quite swimmingly.
Could you give me an idea of a kind of daily routine that you would have?
Yes, we'd. I think I'm right in saying at this time we were now coming into the winter, so we were on the winter program, whereby we did in fact fly through the daylight hours. In the summer, many units opted to work early morning through until lunchtime, and then in the heat of the day, rest up for the afternoon, possibly do some more in the evening. But we were on the normal summer routine, which involved arriving at the flight, We'll have a look at the program for the day, and then we put up on the board which pupil was flying which aircraft and which instructor was supervising those people, and off we'd all go. And there'd be the usual range of activities, starting off with simple dual instruction in the Harvards, of which we had two. We put the new pupils into the front seat of the Harvard and take them up and get them doing circuits and landings. Many of them had flown Harvards, some had not, however. Some had come from twin engine courses in South Africa. They'd been flying Oxfords and had not flown singles after the ab initio Tiger Moths. So it would be circuits and landings in the Harvard, and then we'd thoroughly brief them on the Spitfire cockpit. Then, of course, they'd been studying the pilot's notes for several days beforehand. And the great day would come when we'd launch them off first time into a Spitfire. And I must say, they all took to it without any difficulty. I can't recall any serious incident except one, which was an absolute tragedy, where one of my pilots, one of my pupil pilots, a young fellow called Gray, was briefed for an individual aerobatic exercise, and he texted out, took off, did his exercise, landed, everything perfectly normal and routine. He was taxiing to the end of the runway, and just on the point of turning off the runway, and a Kitty Hawk took off, or attempted to take off, much too early. The hurricane, the Spitfire was still on the runway when the pilot of the Kitty Hawk opened his throttle, and the Spitfire was not clear, and the Kitty Hawk's undercarriage struck the cockpit of the Spitfire and killed the pilot outright. The Kitty Hawk went on flying and went round and landed. In the meantime, as it happened, Neville Duke was in the crew room with me. We saw what had happened, and Neville rushed out. We both rushed out. Neville beat me and got there first and leapt up on the wing stub and switched off the engine, because at this time the Spitfire was doing so circles by itself with the dead pilot in the cockpit. So that was a tragedy, but glad to say that was the only major incident that happened whilst I was commanding the flight. There was one other incident involving the other flight, where for no apparent reason a Spitfire plunged into the ground about 30 miles away from the airfield. It was never discovered why or what happened. It just flew into the ground on a perfectly clear day. I don't know, I can't remember what exercise he was briefed for, but he was by himself. It was probably it might have been a cross country, I'm not sure. And the reason why was never really discovered. Apart from that, elsewhere I had a very, very good, very clean record.
When that happened, would there be an investigation?
Oh, yes,
the accident?
Yes, indeed, yes. There was always a court of inquiry, which was convened instantly. And the very first thing that happened would be that the Form 700, which is the servicing document for each aircraft, the Form 700 would be immediately impounded and used in the evidence in the court of inquiry, because obviously the history of the aircraft had to be known as far as was possible to determine whether serviceability played any part in the incident.
The incident you describe, though, sounds very much like pilot negligence, when with the pilot, the Kitty Hawk pilot, taking off.
Oh, indeed. Indeed it was. I don't know what happened. As it happened, we had some Turkish pilots on the course at the time. And it was a Turkish pilot that caused this accident. What the outcome was, I never heard. The Court of Inquiry was convened. Everybody put in their piece. I said my piece regarding the briefing and the pilot's ability and so on. And then the papers would all have gone forward for examination by the powers that be. And eventually the outcome would be known. So 73 OTU days were very enjoyable in every way. The Canal Zone was a nice place to be. One could get up to Alexandria or down to Cairo or across to Port Said. We had good facilities for everything that we needed. There's plenty of swimming to be had. In the Suez Canal, of all places, not the cleanest, but at least it was swimmable. And we also had a delightful little four-seater aeroplane called a Fairchild Argus. Little four-seater, single-engine, high-wing monoplane, and it was just given to us by the Americans, I believe, for a runabout. And so we certainly ran about in it, and we'd four of us would climb aboard, and we'd flit off down to Heliopolis, which is the RF station on the edge of Cairo, and go and spend a few days enjoying the flesh pots of Cairo, which is a delightful city in those days. I liked it very much, and I knew it. I probably knew Cairo better than I knew London. So life was quite good.
How did you get along with the Egyptians?
Oh, the Egyptians were all right. I think the fact was they knew we were there for a very good purpose. That's not to say they wouldn't have welcomed the Germans if we'd been kicked out. In fact, it's a standing joke that every Arab has got two flags, one of which he hides behind his back, and one will be the Union Jack, and the other one would be a Nazi swastika, and whoever happened to be around at the time would get the benefit of the appropriate flag. I think probably that was generally true. Certainly King Farouk had no love for the British, and we had no love for King Farouk. In fact, he was virtually under house arrest the whole time. But his ministers, I think the political situation was fairly good. We certainly benefited from the Egyptian government, to the extent that we were given the use of a magnificent penthouse suite on the top of the tallest building in Cairo, in Mobilia Building. A great big penthouse suite, which had about 14 bedrooms, would you believe? And a huge lounge and a massive great terrace, and it was given to the RAF by Nahas Pasha, the Egyptian Prime Minister, given to the RAF for their use of air crew during their stay, during their leaves in Cairo. So that was very nice. Well, the Days of the Flesh Pots and Easy Living drew to a close when my posting came through to UK. And in a few days' time, in fact, ready to go? Okay. So, at the end of March 44, I found myself standing on the tarmac early one morning at Heliopolis, watching something I had not seen before. These were the massive four-engine transports DC-4s being operated by the American Air Force Air Transport Service, highly efficient organization which flew large numbers of personnel of all kinds, certainly all over the Middle East and no doubt all over the world. But I had not seen these big aeroplanes before, and this was quite a revelation seeing them this morning at Heliopolis. At that moment I didn't know which aircraft I was going in. There were also Dakotas there, and I was hoping against hope I was going to get onto one of these big four engine ones, and lo and behold, that's just what happened. And I found myself sitting next to a famous film actress of the day, Margaretta Scott, and I was going to have the pleasure of her company all the way home to UK. We landed at Casablanca and refueled and had some food, I believe, and then went on and arrived at Prestwick, as one would expect, on a very grey, damp morning. And in no time at all, I was back home at Wembley. Back home at Kingston, first of all, where I collected my girlfriend, who'd been writing letters for a considerable time to and from wherever I happened to be. And we took ourselves off to Wembley, to my folks' home.
How do you feel about being back in the UK after so much time abroad?
Everything had gone small. Everything was tiny. It was quite extraordinary. The people weren't tiny, but the buildings were, and the buses and the cars, everything was small. And going from one point to another was always a short distance. It was quite extraordinary. It was as though the whole place had just shrunk, which wouldn't be surprising after all the rain. But that was the impression that lasted for quite a little while. So the question then was, what was likely to happen to me? I was posted at the strength of Royal Air Force Station Northolt, and told that there was a policy for some experienced pilots to do administrative work for a few months before going back onto flying operations. And that's what was lined up for me.
How did pilots feel about having to do that policy?
Some were utterly opposed to it, and would go and see everybody under the sun to make sure that they weren't taken off flying. Others were quite happy about it, didn't mind the idea of a bit of a rest. I must confess, I felt I'd done a fair amount of flying, and it wouldn't do any harm. And they said, don't worry, you can always borrow an aeroplane when you feel like it. but you might be doing the ops for a while. So I was sent to North Hold, which was just along the road from Wembley, where my folks lived. And I was put in the chair beside the adjutant and told I was an assistant station adjutant at Royal Air Force North Hold. This was quite remarkable to me because before the war, when I was brought up at Wembley, one of the things that I used to spend a lot of time doing was rushing out into the garden every time an aircraft went over. And it would either be a Hind or a Hart or something from Hendon, where the auxiliary squadrons are located, or it would be a Bulldog or a Gauntlet, or just before the war, a Hurricane would go over the top from North Holt. And I found myself located behind a desk in RAF Station North Holt. It was really quite extraordinary.
What was the airfield like at that time?
It had runways. I think, it had a 2,000-yard runway. It was one of the... I'm not sure whether it was built during the First World War. I suspect it was built during the 20s. It was certainly one of the earlier type stations. The buildings were permanent, of course, and constructed on quite a lavish scale. The officer's mess was really quite a splendid building, with a wonderful outlook out across the airfield. And all the barrack blocks and so on were all permanent construction, hangars. It was a permanent station. And housed 111 Squadron Hurricanes. And I'm not sure which other squadron was there. And so I found myself answering telephones and talking to people. Hadn't the foggiest idea what they're talking about. It probably filtered through to them that I hadn't the foggiest idea what I was talking about. However, my mentor, charming fellow from the First World War, RFC, sorry to say I can't remember his name, but he was very understanding. But I think was glad to have somebody who could pick up the phone now and again. And that went on for a few weeks, and I was posted to Stannington, which is in Northumberland, not far from the town of Morpeth. Hello, my love.
Carry on.
Ready for coffee yet? And this was the School of Administration at Stannington, Northumberland. It was a four-week course during which one was introduced to all the mysteries of duty rosters, promotions, re-gradings, remusterings, and so on, and dealing with the 101 inquiries that would come in from all the different departments around the station.
Was it a policy, obviously, with operational pilots? You mentioned that it is after they've done a certain amount of operations to take an administrative job. But is that the kind of, were they looking at that time to get operational pilots to be in an administrative role, to run airfields as well, to take the kind of station commander roles, that sort of thing, on?
Not to command the entire station, no. Usually it was a station adjutant's job. And indeed, that was the job I was given when I finished the course. Station adjutant, as you may know, has his office, or he has an office immediately next door to the station commander. And his job is to take all the administrative bump out of the station commander's tray, put it in his own tray, and if possible consign it to the waste paper basket. And there's the famous story, of course, about the American general who was completely overwhelmed by all the paperwork that went on in his headquarters office. Having tried all sorts of means and ways of reducing all this paperwork, finally came to one conclusion that the real culprit was the typewriter. And so he immediately scrapped 50% of the typewriter on his station. Immediately the paperwork slowed up and he had a happier life. So that was the adjutant's job, to leave the station commander to get on with important matters, and adjutant had to deal with all the triviality, sorting things out, talking to people, finding out what their problem is and so on.
So is that more of the day-to-day running of the station, in the sense of just not only the administration but the problems that would be brought in that could be solved relatively quickly?
Oh yes, yes, that's right. Yes, anything of a major policy nature, of course, that the station commander would have to deal with that himself. And if he couldn't deal with it, then it would have to go up to group headquarters for the AOC. And if the AOC couldn't deal with it, it would go to command headquarters for the commander-in-chief to sort out. So that was the chain of command, and it worked very well. The essential ingredient, of course, to all this was the orderly room. And the orderly room was where all the paperwork was done, where all the records were kept. All the personnel or documents of all the personnel on the station, they're all kept there. And all the routine things that would come along, like a promotion of, let's say, an AC-1 to leading air craftsman. He was promoted and that paperwork had to be dealt with and the annotations made. Airmen who were changing their jobs, which was called remastering, the paperwork had to be altered so that remastering was shown on the airman's documents. And whenever a person of any rank was posted, his documents, first thing that happened, his documents would be sent to the next station. There were times, of course, when things were moving very fast, when documents tended to lag behind, but sooner or later they caught up, and people's interests and so on were looked after. The important thing always, of course, was that they were getting the correct rate of pay for their rank or mastering.
Would you have had anything to do with disciplinary matters at all?
Oh, yes. Very much so. In fact, everything went through the adjutant on the disciplinary side, be it a minor offence, in which case the individual would be marched into the station commander, and the adjutant would stand beside the station commander with that person's documents in his hand while the matter was being dealt with. A charge against a person would be read out by the station commander, and the person would then be given the opportunity, witnesses would then be called to give their evidence. This would all be heard and recorded, and then the individual would be given the opportunity to speak for himself. The station commander would then weigh the matter and decide whether it was something he could deal with, whether it was a matter that would have to be passed to higher authority in a case of a serious offence, or whether indeed there was no substance, the evidence was insufficient or whatever, and he would dismiss the case. But during all this time, the adjutant would be standing beside the station commander, and if necessary, the matter could be adjourned whilst the evidence was sifted and a conclusion reached. So yes, the adjutant's job was very important. It was important that he had all the necessary documents ready and available. But he would not He would not take a case himself. That was not the adjutant's job. It was always the station commander, or indeed at unit level, i.e. a squadron on a station, the squadron commander would hear that case, and if he could deal with it, he would. Otherwise, he would pass it to the station commander. So this is how the cases came up before the station commander, always from a subordinate level.
What type of disciplinary matters would you have dealt with? Were they all minor, or would there have been occasions?
Mostly minor things, yes. The obvious one was drunkenness and what was described as conduct prejudicial to the maintenance of good order in Air Force discipline. That sort of thing. Sometimes people would cause malicious damage to the barrack block, i.e. breaking a window.